From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The young Al Sharpton jumped into the public eye at the tender age of four when he preached his first sermon as the Wonder Boy Preacher. Now he's taking his message and his baggage before the American people as a Democratic candidate for president. Tonight, On Point, no podium, no altar, no cameras, just Al Sharpton, his message, and you, the voters. We begin with developments in the crisis on the Korean Peninsula. The Pentagon has put 24 long-range bombers on alert for possible deployment within striking range of North Korea. The move follows reports last week that North Korea appears to be moving closer to manufacturing nuclear weapons. David Sanger covers the White House for the New York Times. I asked exactly what's driving the administration's decision to put the bombers on alert.
Well, I think that he's just being cautious at this point. He wants to make sure that there is no adventurism on the part of the North Koreans, no opportunism, as the White House calls it. So that's one explanation, and a good one, because the North Koreans will be watching whatever goes on in Iraq, and when they see that we are distracted there, they may well decide that that's a good moment to go test the system. But there could be a second reason, which is that at some point, the North Koreans are going to begin, we presume, attempting to produce plutonium from their reprocessing plant there. And at that point, the president's going to have a window of a few weeks to a few months to make a decision. And the decision is, do we let them go ahead and deal with them after they have five or six more nuclear weapons, or does he take some kind of action, diplomatic if he can, military if he has to stop them?
David Sanger, you write, and it's obviously the case, that the forward deployment of these bombers gives further military strength to the U.S. forces in the region.
It's a plan for forward deployment. They're not actually moving them right now.
Granted. The point is to beef up that strength should Mr. Bush decide that he cannot allow North Korea to begin reprocessing nuclear fuel into weapons. Can President Bush, under any circumstances, decide that that's permissible, that that's all right?
Well, if you read the national security strategy and you saw what he said about preemption, you would think, no, he can't allow that to happen. On the other hand, dealing with North Korea is a question of allied management. Because remember, if the North Koreans strike back, they don't strike back at us. Mm-hmm. They strike back at South Korea and at Japan.
Massively and devastatingly, quite possibly.
Massively and devastatingly. So then the question is, put another way, Tom, is could the president order a strike against this nuclear facility, even a very precision strike, without the advance permission and cooperation of the South Koreans and the Japanese?
And the answer there?
I don't think that would be forthcoming, or at least there's nothing to make you think right now it would be forthcoming.
So let me put this to you, David Sanger. What makes these bombers a deterrent if the president can, in effect, not use them?
Interesting question. I mean, it may be a deterrent in part to just a conventional threat from North Korea if they decided to do something of a non-nuclear nature. You know, some adventurism along the DMZ, out in the waterways, try to help persuade them not to try another missile test over Japan.
But those really are marginal issues, aren't they? Didn't we hear last week that the report that spent plutonium is being loaded on trucks, that presumably would be to take it to the factory where half a dozen nuclear weapons could be made?
That was our story on Friday, and we don't know where they're taking it, but presumably they want us to think that they're taking it to the reprocessor, or they really are taking it to the reprocessor.
David, have you heard in Washington American military officials or others describing any way that the United States could hit North Korea, could take out the nuclear processing plants without triggering retaliation against South Korea? Do we have a real military option that doesn't sacrifice Seoul and potentially millions of South Koreans?
You know, it is a question of mind reading. And it's mind reading of Kim Jong-il, which is dangerous business. And there is, as you know from your time in Japan, and I know from my time there, this is probably the most heavily reviewed military operation defending South Korea that there is. There's a complete operations plan for it, and it's updated every year or every few years. But in the end, nobody can tell you convincingly how the North Koreans would react.
Additionally, David, if I may, most of those plans would assume a North Korean attack, not a direct first strike by U.S. forces.
Most of the plan was developed that way. However, in 1994, during the last crisis, President Clinton at the time asked for the development of a fairly complex plan in case he decided he had to do the same thing. Remember, at that time, the North Koreans were threatening to reprocess. So it's not a new issue for the Pentagon. There are some people who wrote quite eloquently at that time, including some Republicans, about why the president should have acted then. And some of them believe today that President Bush should, and some others think it's gotten too complicated and he should not.
How soon does this question become critical? If the North Koreans are beginning to move spent plutonium, spent fuel, how soon could the production of new nuclear weapons begin?
It could begin as soon as a month or 2 months from now. Depends on what kind of shape that reprocessing facility was in, and since we haven't seen the inside of it, we don't know. It could be that the North Koreans want us to think that they are starting reprocessing, but they don't actually do it. So that's part of the guesswork.
The stakes hardly get higher than here.
That's right.
David Sanger, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
David Sanger covers the White House for the New York Times. He spoke with us earlier from Washington. The Reverend Al Sharpton is not known for shying away from a public fight. He carried the torch for young Tawana Brawley even when the world turned away in dismay. He was on the front lines at Crown Heights. He paid dearly for both. This time, he's spoiling for a fight with the Democratic Party leadership and the Republicans in a run for the U.S. presidency. With a fiery style built on the revival circuit and a sense of showmanship fashioned on the road with the great James Brown, Al Sharpton has built a political career on the anger of an underclass. Now he's stepping up to the entire nation. Tonight we'll hear his story and his message and ask what Al Sharpton stands for now to you. You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from New York is the Reverend Al Sharpton, president and founder of the National Action Network and Democratic presidential candidate for the 2004 elections. Good evening and welcome, Al Sharpton.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Al Sharpton, if you'd be good enough, I saw a poll just in the last couple of weeks here from a Washington think tank saying that 44% of Americans do not know who Al Sharpton is. I'm sure others think they do and may not. We'd be grateful, before we get into your message and your agenda, and we're going to do that, but if you'd just take a couple minutes and sit back with us and give us, you know, in that time, your bio, your childhood, your coming up, your influences, your adult career. Give us the sketch of who is Al Sharpton.
Well, I began as a boy preacher, as you did accurately state, in the Pentecostal church. And in my pre-teen years, joined the civil rights movement. I was youth director in New York. To New York Operation Breadbasket, appointed by Reverend Jesse Jackson, who was national director at the time, and Reverend William Jones. Operation Breadbasket was the economic rights arm of Martin Luther King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference.
So that would have been in the 60s?
No, that was the end of the 60s, 69 when I was appointed.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And in the 70s, I held that post until we formed National Youth Movement, which was a youth civil rights organization, as well as began mobilizing and voter registration campaigns. I was involved in Shirley Chisholm's campaign for president in 72, and have spent all of my adult life in the capacity of leading a civil rights organization, dealing with public policy issues, everything from police brutality and racial violence to fighting military bases in Vieques and fighting.
And being arrested there, we know.
Correct.
Tell us about your relationship with the great singer James Brown, if you would. How did you connect?
Well,
what was his influence?
That came out of my involvement in the movement. As a young man joined National Youth Movement, the organization. I hit it as a teenager, named Teddy Brown, who was a son of James Brown. And Teddy, unfortunately, was killed in a car accident. James Brown wanted to do something with the youth group that Teddy was committed to, which was our group. And he and I became close, and he was, for many years in the mid-70s, our biggest supporter, and from time to time would take us on the road and help us formed chapters, and he would support us, and I became like a surrogate son to him. I had nothing to do with his music.
You did make some kind of record with James Brown at some point, if I got that right?
No, in the early 80s, he did a gospel record in which he had me do some sermons on it. But it had nothing to do with music. It was me preaching on the only gospel track he ever did called God Has Smiled on Me.
What was it, and we'll move right on from this, but I want to understand your family, I guess, background that got you up at the pulpit at age four. What was the culture that led them to put you there? What was it about you that led them to put you there?
Well, I mean, my family is not a family of ministers. I was a member at three of a Pentecostal church. My parents were. And I felt this great calling, desire to preach at age four. We were doing a junior service. And the adult advisor brought me to our bishop, who said, let him do it. And they did. And I ended up growing there. It is not unheard of in the Baptist or Pentecostal church. It is rare, but it's not unheard of. But it had nothing to do with my family's influence. No one told me to preach, and my father was not a minister.
But we somehow get the sense from the rest of your life that you were not a shy lad.
Well, no, I wasn't a shy lad, and I've not tried to be too shy since then. I think that, if anything, you know, one of the things that is kind of laughable to me is that people always try and assign motives to whatever you do. But at 4 and 5 years old, you're not really old enough to have much motive. You just go by what you really feel and believe, and that's what I did.
And you did. Al Sharpton, fast forward. It's 2003 now. A presidential election campaign is coming right up, and an election coming up next year. Why are you now running for president of the United States? Why are you plunging into the Democratic primary?
Well, I think that for several reasons. One, I think that there are many issues that need to be heard that have not been heard. I've observed in the last three or four national elections people that have been disinherited and the disaffected and who have the majority of Americans. And I've not watched from the sidelines. I have been out there doing voter registration, voter mobilization. Was in Florida. We at National Action Network, the group I've led now for 12 years, filed the first civil rights suit about the voting in Florida. And I've seen the Democratic Party, in my judgment, wander more and more to the right. And I felt that unless someone challenged and brought the issues that had been ignored and would bring the fight to what is going on now in the public arena, the war in Iraq, the military action that is being built up now, the whole tax cut syndrome that Bush is now trying to make permanent, the death penalty. When I look at the fact that a retiring Republican governor has shown more moral strength than any Democratic governor sitting, all of these things were the things that said, one, I feel that I would bring and have an aggressive voice on issues that would go unheard. Second, it would mobilize and register and bring out a lot of voters who have, in many ways, been disaffected and moved out of the process. And third, I think that's the margin of victory. I think the only way that the Democrats can ever be viable again is they have to move away from this right, they call centrist, but this right-wing imitating Republicans and go back to representing the base constituency that they used to represent.
Al Sharpton, we have so much to talk about tonight, but just in the 30 seconds before the break, and we'll come back to it, but the word that comes up out of some Democratic quarters is, Al Sharpton, spoiler, that you will take away that margin of victory, not bring it.
Take it away how?
Well, by walking off the dance floor with a constituency that the Democrats need to put a contender
in
the White House.
Well, first of all, they don't have the constituency, and I hate to give them a bulletin, but they've lost for the last several elections. Look what happened last year in the congressional and Senate races, and I wasn't there. Mm. Well, they're spoiling the lives of people. I think it is ludicrous for people to say that if you're going to bring in a force that has not been represented and raise issues, you're spoiling them when they've been losing because they've been ignoring those people.
Reverend Al Sharpton, we've got it. Please stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight with the Reverend Al Sharpton about his run for the U.S. presidency. What does Al Sharpton stand for to you? Is he an illuminator? Is he a spoiler? Is this candidacy a show of admirable boldness or runaway chutzpah? Join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with the Reverend Al Sharpton about his plans to run, about his run, I should say, for the U.S. presidency. He's opposed to the death penalty, to racial profiling, to war in Iraq, to any kind of unilateral U.S. intervention abroad. He's pro-choice, pro-welfare, pro-affirmative action. He supports gay rights. Is this a voice we need to hear now? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, you've been listening patiently. This is a voice we know in a New York context, in a Northeast context, maybe soon in a national context.
Yes, and I'd like to get to that, if I might. Reverend Sharpton, as you know, politicians often have to shift their positions when they run for president. Senator Lieberman had to bend over, practically 180 degrees to shed some of his positions when he ran with Vice President Gore. You were just at an assembly where Congressman Gephardt had to practically explain his change of heart on abortion to his new group, to a group of abortion supporters. George Bush Sr., Herbert Walker Bush, had overnight to go from being a proponent of abortion rights to someone who was against them, had to go overnight from someone who called Reagan's tax program voodoo economics to someone who stood for it. I'm wondering, Reverend, if you're not in a certain similar position with regard to your political baggage. I mean, let's lay it on the line here. You've been kind of a political incendiary in New York politics, throwing fuel one way or another on racial tensions. And you have an opportunity
now. I would challenge you to cite.
It's tiresome, Reverend, to go into it.
But the Tawana
Brawley case, for example, to any person who possesses sanity, clearly was a shameful episode. Can you make an apology for your part in that and say, look, I was involved in the politics at the time. I made a bad judgment. I regret it. I'm sorry I defamed this man. And I'm sorry that I played other roles in sort of using racial politics in New York. I put that baggage behind me.
First of all, I would again challenge you to say, well, I've been incendiary. I mean, you make a statement, then you go to a question. I'm not going to let you go past your statement. I challenge you to do that. I think that it is very irresponsible for you or anyone to say that for people to pursue causes of justice is incendiary, particularly when we are responding to people that have been victimized, harmed, and come to us for help. How is that incendiary? I think it's incendiary for you to act as if there's something unnatural about people pursuing justice. When Rosa Parks was arrested for desegregating a bus and Martin Luther King and other activists responded, were they being incendiary? I mean, I think that's absurd.
Al Sharpton, if we could, maybe we can just get this Tawana Brawley business out of the way.
No, let's deal with his first statement.
He made a statement about incendiary.
He tied it to that. I heard very clearly what he said, and he's not responded. I mean, the problem you have when you have me on is you can't just run amok and just leave that out.
No, we're not running.
We'll deal with Brawley, but he said the various incendiary incidents. I still say, name them.
Well, I mean, I think that was an example of your exploiting a racial charge to advance your career. You were latching onto this girl and riding high with her and trying to make as much political hay out of her misfortune, which was really a confused young woman, as you could. Now politicians do those things.
That is your assessment.
That's right.
Tawana Brawley was a 15-year-old girl who had been found after 4 days missing. The hospital had said that she was out of consciousness. She, when she came to, said she had been raped. She made a statement. Her family filed whatever their necessary claims were. Two lawyers came in a month later. 3 months later, they asked for me and my support. Bill Cosby and others supported her. And I stood with her as I have stood with any number of victims since then. For you to phrase that as exploiting her is the height of arrogance. It's also a rewrite of history. She asked for our support, and we gave it to her.
Reverend Sharpton?
Exploiting, Yes.
May I just ask along that line, just to get to, I guess, where that story goes is, as of course you know, a grand jury eventually found that the story was without merit.
No, that's not true. A grand jury report issued by the Attorney General of the state said he did not believe it was merit. Two members of the grand jury said that they didn't believe that at all. And I can name you any number of juries. I'm sure many of your listeners don't believe in the verdict of O.J. Simpson. Does that make them incendiary? I disagree with the findings of that grand jury. There's nothing exploitative about that. And around the same period of time, five young men were indicted, prosecuted, and convicted for rape in Central Park in New York. Mm-hmm. I followed that case. Their parents asked me for support there. I supported them. 13 years later, some of them went to jail for 7 years. The courts have now come and overturned those convictions. So, I mean, what exploitive how? We respond to cases of justice. The same time period that I stood up for Tawana Brawley was the time period I stood up for the Central Park jogger case. That now, 13 years later, the very courts have said we were right about that.
Reverend Sharpton, I guess the thrust of Jack Beattie's question goes to the kinds of evolution politicians undergo when they step up to a national stage. Sometimes there are things, baggage that has to be shed, that somehow put beyond them to be effective on that national stage, which raises, I guess, two questions in my mind. Last Friday, the former assistant district attorney, Stephen Pagones, raised again this question, saying, will Al Sharpton came out finally and say, I was wrong? That's question number one. Will you do that? And secondly, do you have to do that to be effective on the national political stage as a candidate for the president of the United States?
First of all, I think that what Jack did was a little disingenuous. He raised policy positions on Lieberman and Bush and others, and he raised a particular case with me. He's not talking about me having a policy position in terms of fighting for justice. He's talking about whether I would change a position on a particular case. And the answer is no. As far as Mr. Pagones, who was accused by Tawana Brawley, who we all believed in, what is strange to me is why would he want those that believe Brawley to apologize? Why doesn't he ask Brawley to apologize if he felt there was some apology necessary?
Apparently she's no longer, her whereabouts are no longer known. But you're very public.
He knows where she is. He sued her. So, I mean,
but he's never collected because she's out of pocket.
Do y'all make it up as you go, or do you do research? It's clear he knows where she is. What are you saying?
All I know is what I read in the Associated Press story, that her address is no longer known, and she hasn't paid the $500,000 settlement that he won against her.
I'm sure he knows where she is. But again, if you made an allegation and you were a victim, why would I go after your supporters and not go after you, unless maybe now I have a political agenda? So I think there's a little suspect about that. But the answer is, do I feel that the attorneys and I were wrong to believe in that young lady and her parents? The answer is no. Like, I have now been proven to be right about Central Park, about Abner Louima, about Amadou Diop, 20 years of cases. And to be effective nationally, absolutely. Not only have we not had a problem being effective nationally, we haven't been had a problem being effective in the state where it happened. I think this is the meager attempt of some in the media who can't come with anything substantive to try to take one case out of 25 years because I'm sure they would have loved to use Central Park, but unfortunately for them, that was overturned.
Reverend Shepard,
your opening, you said I was on the front lines of Crown Heights. Front lines of Crown Heights doing what? I got the Crown Heights after the violence and preach the eulogy. So these rewrites of history sometimes work in New York, but they don't work nationally, and they have proven to not work in New York given to how we've been able to build a political movement.
I don't want to stay tangled in this one forever, but in your 1992 U.S. Senate primary run, you got 2% of the white vote. That was on the heels of the Brawley case. Does that matter? I guess the real question is, do you need at some level to turn your message and your face to the world as you go national? Or are you committed to bringing the same voice that you've had in New York to that national stage, and will it work there?
Well, first of all, again, you make statements that don't make sense in all due respect. 2% of the white vote may have nothing to do with Brawley. The fact is, I was the first black to ever run for U.S. Senate in the state. You'd have to ask yourself, what was the racial climate of the state? Mm-hmm. Jesse Jackson ran for president 4 years before that and got 7% of the white vote nationally. Mm-hmm. Do you have a case that's responsible for that? I mean, to act as though the case had something to do with the results, I think is a huge leap, sir.
All right, we'll move it right off the case. but speak to the facts of it, speak to the dynamic, and I guess the same question remains. As you move to the national stage, are you committed to the same route that brought you up, or are you looking to...
I'm absolutely committed to the same route. As I said, I've been in civil rights all of my life, and we have fought for many situations all my life. I don't come to the stage as to try and change for a career move. I come to the stage to try and say that these issues that have been ignored need to be looked upon. Why would I then get to the stage and change the reason I'm coming to the stage in the first place? I think that's what's wrong with politicians, is that they come with a real commitment towards certain values and principles, and they become intoxicated with people telling them you need to do this in order to win something rather than stand by their principles and win anyhow. Because I think that the winning is going to be those that stand for something and that don't allow misguided and ill-informed and frankly lazy pundits who don't do their research before they get on shows like this asking questions.
Give us your analysis then of the Democratic Party primary and then the ultimate election. How do you see the Sharpton message coming here and making the party a winner, not a loser? How does it work?
I think that it works because, one, it will appeal to a lot of people that, A, are unilaterally opposed to the military action in Iraq, that does not see how we can, with no clear evidence, go in and engage in a military action in Iraq, and how many of those that are in this race voted to give Mr. Bush the power in order to do that. I think that, B, it will bring in a lot of people that want to take head on this whole spirit of business deregulation. It was the deregulation matrix, I think, that led to the Enrons and the WorldComs. And unfortunately, some of the leadership of the Democratic Party was a part of that. I think the message is clearly anti-death penalty. So I think as you expand the base, many of whom has stopped voting, left the party, some voted for Ralph Nader, I think those numbers are the numbers that can make the difference, not only in me winning at the top, but also in Senate races and congressional races, which will be on the ballot in 2004. We've tried the DLC, the so-called centrist, which I consider right-wing Democratic way. It hasn't worked.
But do you mean Bill Clinton by that?
The only one that has won was Clinton, and Clinton wouldn't have won if Perot hadn't been in the race, but we didn't win the Congress. In fact, Newt Gingrich's revolution in 94 killed it. You come again with a debacle in 2002. How many times do you use the same strategy and lose before you say this is not working for the party?
Jack Beatty, how do you see the Al Sharpton factor playing out in the Democratic primary in the 2004 presidential election?
Well, I think as the left candidate, he has a responsibility. He has a burden to raise issues. And I'd like to just get a kind of yes or no on some of them, Mr. Sharpton. To get to the bottom of it, basically, you can't organize a union in this country. I mean, the laws are such that that's not possible, pretty much. Ever since labor law reform was defeated in the late 70s, unions have just gone downhill. So has the American standard of living. Will you hold the feet of these politicians to the fire on labor law reform?
Absolutely. In fact, one of the things that I've been involved in has been moving with labor for years. That may be one reason why when we recently had the fire in our headquarters in New York, Local 1199 stepped up and said we need to preserve that voice and gave us office space because we're allied with unions. Union busting from Reagan with the airline traffic controllers all the way to what we've seen around certain municipalities has been an order of the day and has been happening with basically laryngitis by Democratic leadership. I think we must deal with addressing this and making this a national issue in terms of these reform laws that need to be put in place to protect people's right to organize, unions' right to organize workers.
Jack, what else is on your punch card?
Well, the other one would be the living wage. Will you raise that issue with these candidates?
I think the living wage must not only be raised, I think it must be championed, particularly when you have a president that has now, as of yesterday, projected that we are going in 5 years into a $1 trillion deficit spending, and his answer is to give tax cuts permanent tax cuts to those that are wealthier, dividend tax cuts to people with retirement funds, who clearly he's not talking about those on that are in the working class category. I think that it is absolutely a necessary issue that must be championed, because who's going to guarantee everyday working class people are going to have a guaranteed income?
Jack, Reverend Sharpton, if you can hold that list for just a second, I want to get some callers in here. A lot of them want to join us. Jacqueline's calling from Melrose, Massachusetts. Hi, Jacqueline. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you. Reverend Sharpton, I admire all your stands you've expressed this evening, and I've known about them before. I agree with all of them, and I'm especially happy that you oppose the war so much. But why, Reverend, hasn't there been more talk from everybody in this country about the very likelihood, the assurance that if we attack a Muslim country and kill the innocent Muslims there in that country who have done nothing to us, isn't that going to stir up a lot more retaliation and terrorism, which was our number one concern before the president switched it to Saddam?
Jacqueline, we've got it. Al Sharpton, your response.
I think that she raises an interesting point. I think which is very interesting to me in that line is that at the State of the Union address, the one name we did not hear Mr. Bush mention was bin Laden. He promised on September 11th, we're going to get bin Laden. We don't even hear about bin Laden anymore. So I think that it is very interesting when she talks about the switch to Hussein. I think it's interesting to that she raises what will be the reaction of others if we do go into war. So not only don't I see the evidence, I don't see the strategy that protects American people if we are bent on a war in Iraq, nor do I understand why we're not after those that we claim have already attacked American shores, rather than we're bent on going at people that we think may have weapons and may do something to us. I'd be more bent on who has done something to me.
Do you expect any other Democratic presidential candidate to come outright against the war?
I have no idea. I don't see why they would not. I don't know how, first of all, anyone justifies it. Second of all, that is my problem, and that is one of the reasons I'm challenging in the party. How do you call yourself the opposition party if you're not opposed to Jack, what is going on?
Jack Beatty, can this be a winning line for the Democrats, or is this a recipe for division and defeat?
Well, it seems to me that Democratic primary voters are more liberal than Democratic voters in general, and they're much more liberal than the electorate in general. And that argues that there's a strong anti-war feeling among them, not certainly against the war on terrorism, but about the Iraqi imbroglio. And it seems to me that Howard Dean, who's also against this venture, as well as Reverend Sharpton, has an opening there, which the other candidates have pretty much given.
Well, but does it add up to a victory, or is it a moral victory alone?
Well, I don't know about that, but it certainly gives him something to say as a candidate that only one other candidate will be saying, and I think that will resonate among many voters, many Democratic primary voters.
We've got a lot of callers and a lot more to talk about. We've got Reverend Al Sharpton with us tonight about his run for the U.S. presidency. You can join the conversation. Are you ready for Al Sharpton? Does he have something to say to you? Is this a voice we need to hear? Is this a voice Democrats should welcome or run from? And Republicans, what role do you see for Al Sharpton in the 2004 election? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beatty, Al Sharpton, stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University, this is...
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with the Reverend Al Sharpton about his run for the U.S. presidency. You are welcome to join the conversation. What does Al Sharpton stand for to you? Is he an illuminator? Is he a spoiler? What will be the impact of an Al Sharpton presidential candidacy? How will Al Sharpton play in Iowa, in South Carolina? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Siddiqui's calling from Roxbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Siddiqui. You're on the air.
Good evening. How are you doing?
Fine.
Yeah, I didn't call to talk specifically about Reverend Sharpton's candidacy, but I did call in regards to the Tawana Brawley situation.
Mm-hmm.
To offer some clarity to that in fact, I was involved in some respects because of the fact that I, back at the Riverside Church, in fact, I met the Reverend at that time several years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I spoke at a rally for Tawana Brawley. and had an opportunity, you know, gotten all the news reports, but had an opportunity to sit down with her and discuss her situation in depth. And when, you know, she gave a description of her story in terms of, first of all, the bottom line is that the explanation that was given was that she, in fact, took herself out there on a cold night, wrapped herself in plastic, bruised herself, and covered herself with feces, and did this because she was trying to find an excuse because she was afraid to go home because she was late for a curfew with her father. Now, I don't think that a young lady would go to that extent. And let me also say that she did go to the hospital, and mysteriously, a lot of her medical records disappeared. They acknowledged that she, in fact, did check in, and there appeared to be some injuries. So I just made this call to say that in terms of the court situation or whatever, that as far as I'm concerned, that's on the perimeter of the situation.
Well, and yet we know how the grand jury ultimately came out, but yet we hear what you're saying, Siddiqui. But I don't want to be entirely tied up in that, if you don't mind.
Well, no,
speak to us, if you would take it forward. You're listening to Al Sharpton tonight. You're hearing what he's saying for the country. You're hearing the questions being raised about whether this helps the Democratic Party, hurts the Democratic Party. What's your view of Al Sharpton as a presidential candidate, Siddiqui?
Well, let me just say this, that, you know, I believe that the Reverend has been out there and that, you know, he's made a choice to, in fact, run for the presidency of the United States. And, you know, I think that he has the right to do that. And if he's, you know, if he's willing to put out the issues and to be honest about it, then he has the right to do that. And I don't think that, you know, that he should be attacked. I mean, evidently he's a legitimate candidate in the eyes of the Constitution of this country. And so he, in fact, should be addressed just like
any
other candidate.
No question. Siddiqui, thank you for your call. Reverend Sharpton, if I may put to you, in your book that just came out last fall, Al on America, you write about your run for the president as a matter of identity, but by which I assume you mean racial identity. You have spoken up for African Americans for many years. How does that jive with running for presidency of the entire United States? Is there a tension there or not?
You should read the book. I said identity in terms of the party identifying what does it stand for. It has nothing to do with race. And I specifically raised that in the book. I think what my running will do, aside from leading to victory, it'll be therapeutic for a lot of you guys in the media. Because, again, you say to me, I assume you talk about something when clearly there's almost 300 pages and that clearly says that's exactly what I'm not talking about. Just like
I haven't got your book yet, but I put my assumption on the table.
I appreciate your assumption. But let me give you an example. If any other candidate is on, are you going to ask them, are they good for America? Are they good for the party?
Yes.
Are you going to ask John Edwards or Jolie how they going to play in Harlem or South Central Chicago?
Absolutely. See, are we going to ask them how they play with minority Americans?
A lot of the media is so condescending. They don't even understand it. When people that are different raise, it's a different standard. And I think that that in itself is why a lot of people, and who happen now to be the majority of Americans, become just tired of the process. I'm willing to fight that because I want to see the majority of Americans back in the process and stand up to these guys that act like there's something abnormal about our being involved in wanting to run a country that we live in and try to build and raise our families.
I think there's nothing abnormal about it, and I respect anyone who runs seriously for the presidency of the United States, but I have to wonder, I mean, do you think that to me this is the normal rough and tumble of politics? Why is that to you condescending?
Because in the normal rough and tumble of politics, I don't hear other candidates. You have people.
Trent Lott is no longer sitting on top of the pile. There were some pretty hard questions asked about a comment he made at a birthday party.
But we're not talking about a comment at a birthday party. We're talking about you say whether or not one is good for the party or not, rather than one is a good candidate or not. And I'm saying to you that my running is a legitimate extension of a movement that have run people before, from Shirley Chisholm to Jesse Jackson to any number of people. I mean, and I think that America has to adjust again to the fact that if the party is going to work, it's going to have to expand and deal with people, because if they don't, they will never win because the majority of the people are not responding. One of the reasons is because they are so tied up in their own narrow way that they're not hearing people, therefore people are not responding to them.
Al Sharpton, I think we are hearing you on the issues tonight. Jack Beattie, do you see a special knife out for Al Sharpton that's sharper than the knife that comes out for any other presidential candidate?
I do, and I think he's right about the condescension. I think we especially in the white media, tend to do that, and I think we tend to do it in the millionaire media as well, which is to say the Sunday talk shows.
But wait, Jack, I have to just ask there, do you really believe that John Edwards or any other Democratic presidential candidate won't be asked about how he'll play in minority communities in the United States, that they won't be asked?
I haven't heard.
Well, they certainly wouldn't be on this show.
I don't want to step on your answer, Jack, but I've watched them. I've never heard anyone. I'll give you an example. I've been involved, as you stated, since I was a kid in a movement. Mr. Edwards, who I respect, just got elected to office 4 years ago, his first office in his career. Nobody's going to say, Mr. Edwards, is this some overambition? Is this blue ha ha?
Yeah, but he's been made light of as a pretty boy. You've heard that. It's not that.
No. But we're talking about how they are handled and questioned. And again, I enjoy it because it exposes the very reason that I'm trying to say that people are tired of the process and tired of people that play this game differently for different people.
Well, I'm willing to believe there's a different approach, and yet I have seen just how rough it is out there, and I frankly, Al Sharpton, can't see you as in a category of one when it comes to tough treatment. Ask Gary Hart about that. Ask a lot of people about that. On the racial front, the Republican Party's been all over the coals in the last month about how they're going to deal with it. It's a very open conversation.
Well, let's just take what you just said. Mm. Mr. Bush, in the last few weeks, came out against affirmative action, mm-hmm. right?
Yes,
I've
he
not
did.
Heard one reporter raise to him how he himself went to two colleges based on preferences. Now, to his credit, it has been written on the op-ed page of New York Times, but when George Bush sits down in press conferences, nobody says that you went to Andover and went to Yale on preferences. In fact, your grades were so low, if you didn't have preferences, you wouldn't have went there. But they would have no problem asking a candidate that they consider an outsider. That's what I'm talking about. The tone of the questioning is different. And it's good because it exposes why we need this kind of therapy in this season.
Well, we duly note it. And I'm not entirely convinced, but I hear the case. We have a lot of callers who want to speak with you. Jay's calling from Boston. Hi, Jay. You're on the air.
Yes. Good evening, Tom. Good evening, Jack. Good evening. And good evening, Reverend Sharpton. One of the things that I hear from Reverend Sharpton's comment, and I follow him throughout the media, and every time he's on the radio and television, have a tendency to attack all the other Democratic candidates. And Reverend Sharpton, I hope to God that when you all guys going to get together and debate the issue as a Democratic candidate, and I hope that the attack and all the issues should be pointed to the Republican. And if you guys are going to attack each other at this stage, then obviously you're going to give a huge advantage to Republican. For instance, now we have a defense budget proposed by the Bush administration, $350 billion. And on the other hand, we have so many homeless veterans, even in Boston, that they raise money to pay their electricity. We're talking about the very people that the Bush administration right now threaten the whole world to go to war. If they're lucky, they come home alive and they become veteran, and the next day they become homeless. These are the issue, and I hope that you raise all the time and let the people in America do hear this loud and clear.
Jay, we've got it. Let me put it to Reverend Sharpton. Here's the question again. Can you have that knockdown, drag-out fight within the Democratic Party? Do you have to have it? Do you come out so wounded that you can't actually get the power to implement policy?
I think that as long as the debate is around policy and direction of the party, that you not only don't come out too wounded, you come out stronger. If it was a bunch of personal attacks, which I've not made any personal attacks, I've said I disagree with how they voted on issues that Bush and others have stood for. So for me to say that I disagree with Democrats that are playing right-wing politics is to say that we need to clearly take the Republicans on and not try to be like them. I think that will strengthen the party. I agree with him, if we were just into a bunch of mudslinging, it would kill the party. I think that we've got to address what is the difference. That's what I raised in the book, about identity. What is the difference between a Democrat and Republican today? When I was growing up, we knew what a Democrat stood for. Now we have a bunch of elephants running around with donkey jackets on calling themselves Democrats.
What exactly is your critique of that Democratic Leadership Council, the centrist group, as it self-described?
Well, my critique is their own self-definition. They are pro-big business, pro-military buildup, pro-death penalty. They themselves call themselves centrists. And I think that their particular political philosophy, in my judgment, does not serve first the American public, and is certainly, in my judgment, does not represent the base of Democratic voters.
Bill's calling. Welcome, Bill. You're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
I enjoy your show, first of all, Tom.
Thank you.
And, Jack, hi to you as well. Hi. Mr. Sharpton, the more I listen to you, the more I'm convinced that you are my candidate. No doubt, my brother. Keep up the good work. Let me say a couple of things. First of all, the reason you have Condoleezza Rice, Secretary Powell, and whatever smattering of minorities in that White House today is because of Bill Clinton's candidacy. When Bill Clinton ran for president way back in 1992, he said he was going to have a party that looked like America. And what he did was he put a lot of minority, particularly blacks, in the White House, in his cabinet, in his appointments, in federal judges, and so on and so forth. The reason? Because Jesse Jackson ran in 1984 and 1988 and put pressure on that Democratic Party to make them respond the way they did. Now, Bill Clinton went to Jesse Jackson when he ran in 1992 and asked him not to run in 1992. Because he said that basically he'd be taken away from the party. That operated as a point of leverage for the political system.
Do you think that can happen, will happen again with the candidacy of Al Sharpton?
Though? Absolutely will happen again. And that's just the minor part of it. But most importantly, I listened to Brother Sharpton articulate all these issues very effectively, very forcefully, and no matter how strong the opposition, the man stands right in there. That's what I want in a candidate. If those can vote for Ralph Nader in the past election, presidential election, can take a stand from the Green Party on the far left of the Liberal Democratic Party.
Bill, we got it. And forgive me, but our time's running down. I want to get more Al Sharpton. Al Sharpton, we've just got a couple minutes left. How have African Americans been treated by the Democratic Party?
Well, I don't think that African Americans or Latinos or women, for that matter, in three distinct different ways, have been treated very well at all. In many ways, I think we've been told that we want your vote, but we can't identify with your interests, and that we've got to try and go for the moderate white male. We haven't been able to get him. We're losing the natural constituency base we have. I think Bill is right. It's time for us to really stand up and say that we've got to reassess our relationship in the party. 20 years ago, Reverend Jackson did it and did it well. I think we need to do it again and even do it more successfully by winning. And I think that if one studies what happened in the 80s, one can say that maybe it's time to do that again and finish the course.
Al Sharpton, we are out of time, but we will be watching and we will be listening. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
The Reverend Al Sharpton, Democratic candidate for President of the United States. Jack Beatty, he's a fighter.
Yes, and he will bring, he will certainly liven up that Democratic field. He's a skilled debater, and he knows the issues, and he's aware of a huge vulnerability of the Democrats, the distance between the official party and its base. It's been opening for years. It cost them the last election, and that's his turf.
Three states, New Hampshire, South Carolina, Iowa. Will it play?
Well, I have no idea, but it will be interesting, that's for sure.
It sure will. Jack, thank you for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.